88.1 KFCF in Fresno and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
And any time you hear anybody say that John Kennedy, like Lyndon Johnson, had something to do with our getting involved in the war in Vietnam, you are listening to a man who doesn't know what he's talking about.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, the assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview, part one. In this 1988 radio documentary, you will hear the voices of the narrator, Roscoe, co-producer and writer David Mendelsohn, interviewing former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, filmmaker Oliver Stone, Lee Harvey Oswald in a 1963 radio interview, and professor and author Philip Melanson. The assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview, was co-produced, edited, and directed by Andrew Phillips.
And an old soldier, Dwight Eisenhower, whose warning in the closing moments of his 8 years in the White House would be remembered by many as the prophetic speech of his career.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
This is a story about America. America, which proclaims that democracy means a government of, by, and for the people. America, which condemns foreign governments run by military dictatorships, societies ruled by the powerful few, who alone are party to decisions which affect the many. Where the process of leadership goes on behind closed doors, and presidents come and go without the people even knowing why. This is a story about that moment in America when the government changed and the people were excluded, not just from choosing their leader, but from knowing why their leadership changed. This is a story about that day in Dallas, the day John Kennedy died.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. Put me on, Phil. Put me on. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car.
For some time they were saying Castro killed Kennedy, and I think the current vogue now for the agency is to publish books saying the mob and all these ridiculous things, when any thinking person can look at the facts and see clearly that the main conflict was between Jack Kennedy and the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, it was on the front page of the New York Times in 1963, the split between the two of them. It came to a point where Jack Kennedy said, I'm going to tear the agency in 1,000 to 1,000 pieces. It just happened the agency tore him before he got a chance.
The Dallas Police radio tape, on which four rifle shots in the correct time sequence have been superimposed.
That bringing out the truth is so critical that these words must be said. The American people have to face the fact that this is not an oversight, not a mistake on somebody's part. Every day that passes, high individuals at the very top of the United States government are playing an active role in concealing from you the truth of John Kennedy's murder.
Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire.
There's a lot of money to be made and has been made in keeping the Cold War going. And so there are a lot of, there are billions.
Just billions. Just billions, that's all. Keeping the Cold War going means many billions coming in, and that's one of the reasons they killed Jack Kennedy to keep it going.
There are many unanswered questions concerning the death of President Kennedy, and there are several credible theories. In this program, we will present Judge Garrison's memories, views, and supporting evidence concerning his investigation. This is not a definitive examination of the tragic events of 1963, but the Garrison interview is an important audio document of a crucial and little understood moment of American history. Millions of Americans have seen Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, which focuses on Garrison's investigation in 1967. But very few have heard Judge Garrison recount his work and his message for America in his own words. In 1988, Sheridan Square Press, a division of the Center for Media Analysis, which published Garrison's memoir, On the Trail of the Assassins, described the book this way. 25 years ago, on November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas, Texas. Within hours, it was learned that Lee Harvey Oswald, who was arrested for the crime, had lived in New Orleans the preceding summer. New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison immediately commenced an investigation and arrested a suspicious former CIA pilot and anti-Castro soldier of fortune named David Ferry. He turned Ferry over to the FBI for questioning, but shortly thereafter, federal authorities released him. 10 months later, the Warren Commission report ratified the official story that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin of the president. It was not until 3 years later that Jim Garrison returned to the investigation, after his friend Senator Russell Long confided to him his suspicion that the Warren Commission was dead wrong. Thus commenced an intensive and tortuous inquiry filled with bizarre characters that resulted in the only criminal prosecution ever brought for the murder of President Kennedy. As this harrowing tale reveals, Garrison painstakingly uncovered evidence, ignored by the Warren Commission, that members of the U.S. intelligence community had conspired to kill President Kennedy and that Lee Harvey Oswald had been set up as their fall guy. Among the key conspirators were Ferry, fanatical former FBI agent Guy Bannister, who was deeply involved with Cuban exiled mercenaries, and a distinguished pillar of New Orleans society, Clay Shaw, the director of the International Trade Mart. As Garrison built his case, crucial witnesses, including David Ferry, died mysteriously. Documents disappeared, the DA's office was repeatedly infiltrated, and, most intriguing of all, the federal government not only withheld its cooperation, but attacked the investigation. The media waged an intensive campaign vilifying Garrison, aimed at discrediting his case against Clay Shaw and corroborating the official story. Now, 2 decades after the Shaw trial, Jim Garrison finally tells his own story. He pieces together his thesis that President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy and cover-up involving elements of the CIA, the FBI, and state and local officials, all of them hell-bent on reversing the president's bold moves to lessen the tensions of the Cold War.
Every major move he made, and I'm saying move, not words, on this day he was sworn in, which are written for him by members of the staff. I mean, every major decision he made as president was toward ending the Cold War. So if you hear anybody describe him with a straight face as Cold War, you're talking to somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. Kennedy did so much and made so much progress towards ending the Cold War that those Cold Warriors who were in our government had to kill him in order to keep the Cold War going.
What changes in policy can you point to that occurred after his assassination, where we might see a turnabout from earlier Kennedy policies to the new Johnson policies?
There were a series of them, but the most immediate one occurred within 72 hours after his assassination. His successor, Lyndon Johnson, who was a closet Cold Warrior all the time, and who in the Senate was known as the Senator from the Pentagon, because of his war-oriented philosophy, within 72 hours of John Kennedy's death, right after the eulogy in the rotunda, Lyndon Johnson crossed over to the old office building and met with the ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Lodge, and said, in effect, you can go back and tell the Vietnamese now that we're going to back them all the way. In other words, what he was doing within 72 hours, no position papers, no 6 weeks, 2 months studies by the military and intelligence, within a few days, He was meeting with the Lodge and telling him, we are changing the policy in the Far East 180 degrees. He reversed Kennedy's policy, and sure enough, in 18 months, he was pouring 500,000 American soldiers in there, an expeditionary force, with no reason. We were not even invited by South. We weren't wanted by South Vietnam. Of course, the result, as you know, was not only did we lose 55,000 fine young men, died, murdered by our own government, in a sense, but we got in a war which was not supported by the people, but was kept alive nevertheless by successively by Johnson and then by Nixon, to the point where in riots in Washington, D.C., they had to arrest 20,000 American citizens protesting the war. By those Nazi methods, they managed to make a war nobody wanted last 9 years. But with Kennedy, we would not have had the war because he said most specifically on the 2nd of October, 1963, he told Kenny O'Donnell, and it's in Kenny O'Donnell's book, Johnny, We Hardly Knew You, we're getting out of Vietnam. We will be completely out by 1965. That means the helicopters and everything. And incidentally, when he said that, we did not have a single combat soldier in Vietnam. As long as Jack Kennedy was alive, we did not have a single combat soldier in Vietnam. And any time you hear anybody say that John Kennedy, like Lyndon Johnson, had something to do with our getting involved in the war in Vietnam, you are listening to a man who doesn't know what he's talking about.
What is the evidence supporting the theory that JFK would not have carried out the Johnson-Vietnam policy of full-scale war, which led to 550,000 American ground troops and daily B-52 bombing runs, in the end dropping twice as much explosive force on that small country as was dropped by both sides in all of World War II. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., writing in the January 10, 1992 edition of the Wall Street Journal, no one can say what President Kennedy might eventually have done about Vietnam, but there is strong documentary evidence as to his long-run purpose. From the beginning to end of his administration, he steadily opposed repeated military recommendations that he introduce an American expeditionary force. Having watched the French army fail in Vietnam in 1951, he had no desire to send the American army into the same quagmire. The last thing he wanted, said General Maxwell Taylor, was to put in our ground forces. In the hope of enabling the South Vietnamese to save themselves, President Kennedy did agree to modest increases in the number of U.S. military advisers assigned to the South Vietnamese Army. But as Roswell Gilpatrick, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, said later, resistance was encountered from the president at every stage as the total amount of U.S. personnel deployment increased. In July 1962, President Kennedy instructed Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, to start planning for the phased withdrawal of the American advisers. The target date for complete disengagement was the end of 1965. The military produced an acceptable plan in May 1963. Mr. Gilpatrick later said, McNamara indicated to me that this was part of a plan the president asked him to develop to unwind the whole thing.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. Here, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, in his second appearance at the National Press Club, Oliver Stone.
The central historical question raised by JFK, of course, has to do not with the tramps in Dealey Plaza, not with who might have been firing from the grassy knoll, not with what coalition of Cubans, exiles, mobsters, rogue intelligence officers the conspiracy might have been concocted by, but the darker stain on the American ground in the 60s and 70s, Vietnam. It is Vietnam which has become the bloody shirt of American politics, replacing slavery of 100 years before. Just as we did not resolve, if we ever did, the great battle over slavery, until 100 years after the Civil War, when we passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, so it becomes clear that the Vietnam War remains the watershed of our time. And the divisions in our country among our people opened up by it seem to gape wider and wider with each passing year. JFK suggests it was Vietnam that led to the assassination of John Kennedy, that he became too dangerous, too strong an advocate of changing the course of the Cold War, too clear a proponent of troop withdrawal for those who supported the idea of a war in Vietnam and later came to support the war itself. Was President Kennedy withdrawing from Vietnam? Had he indicated strongly his intention to do so? Had he committed himself firmly and against all hawkish advice to the contrary to oppose the entry of U.S. combat troops? The answer to these questions is unequivocally yes. As Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has attested, and Major John Newman, a young historian here on this dais who has devoted himself to a 10-year study of this, can attest. His book, JFK in Vietnam, a major work, will surely contribute more heavily than any other volume of immediate military history to the solution of these questions. Major Newman makes it very clear, President Kennedy signaled his intention to withdraw from Vietnam in a variety of ways and put it firmly on the record with the National Security Action Memorandum 263 in October of 1963. Those who try to say it was no more than a call for a rotation of troops or a gimmick or, and that the Johnson NSAM 273 within a week of the assassination merely confirmed the policy ignore the obvious question. If LBJ was merely continuing Kennedy's policies, why was it necessary to reverse the NSAM?
The first order he gave in that regard was to return 1,000 of our troops as a gesture that could not be misunderstood, 1,000 troops by the end of December 1963. But that was countermanded within 24 hours of his death, which gives you some idea of how much backing he had from his own government.
Let's look at his Cuba policy. Bay of Pigs would certainly seem like it was an anti-communist move.
The Bay of Pigs was not his policy. The Bay of Pigs was inherited from the previous administration. And the main designer and supervisor of the Bay of Pigs was a man named Richard Nixon, who later, when he got back in office, helped to keep the Vietnam War going. He was one of the Cold Warriors, a dedicated Cold Warrior from the first time he entered public office. But that was not Kennedy's policy. Kennedy inherited that, and his position, and he left no doubt about it, was I don't have much alternative. People think that I'm failing to follow up on the previous president if I don't go ahead with something that he's initiated, but he was not very enthusiastic about it. He was most reluctant, and the invasion of the Bay of Pigs of Cuba, as you know, was being accomplished by anti-Castro Cubans, trained and backed, of course, by American advisors, by the CIA project. But it was insufficiently backed, and this agency thought that it could jam Jack Kennedy into bringing in the Navy fighter planes, which were just over the horizon on the Navy flat tops. Their engines were even warmed up, so they were obviously intended to be used. But Kennedy didn't intend to bring us into World War III that casually. And so when the man in charge of the Bay of Pigs, General Cabell, Charles Cabell, who just by strange coincidence happened to be the brother of Mayor Earl Cabell, in whose town Jack Kennedy was murdered a year or two later, when General Charles Cabell called on President Kennedy to make the Navy planes available, John Kennedy said, absolutely not, and returned him down. So that was not really John Kennedy's project at all. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis, when that was laid on John Kennedy, he recognized it for the crisis it was, for the possible beginning of World War III, but it's important to see that in its perspective. It's becoming increasingly apparent, I think, to most thinking Americans, and I certainly have no brief for the Russians because I happen to be on the American side and served most of my adult life in the service. But it's becoming increasingly apparent to most Americans that the reason the Russians put the missiles in there was they wanted to discourage any further American adventurism or landing in Cuba. And in any case, whichever view you take, the crisis was laid upon us by those missiles. And Kennedy's view, certainly the right view, was we had to get those missiles out of there. But the approach recommended to him by the military and our intelligence advisors around Kennedy was to bomb and invade Cuba. A desire, much desired, of course, by the military and intelligence. But Kennedy replied, as only Kennedy could, wouldn't that kill an awful lot of Cubans? And so he found the solution that they didn't dream of, because you can't deny his intelligence nor his imagination. And the solution which he was able to work out, communicating through the Russian ambassador and with Khrushchev of Russia, they worked out a solution in which Kennedy's solution was the blockade. Without firing shots, without bombing Cuba, without killing Cuba, we simply set up a blockade. And at first, reluctantly, and then finally, realizing that was the best solution, the Russians ended up pulling out their missiles. And that was what I think can fairly be described as a resolution of the Cuban crisis without drawing the United States into a war. At the same time, it was not a Cold War move. It was an anti-Cold War move because it used reason rather than force to resolve the problem. The reaction of the Cubans and the anti-Castro individuals who were being trained, they were being trained north of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans. Guy Bannister, former special agent in charge of the Chicago office, by 1962 and 63 was working for the Central Intelligence Agency. And his right-hand man was David Ferry, who comes into the story later. But Guy Bannister was operating this anti-Castro movement, which was completely in opposition to everything that Kennedy was talking about and had in mind. It contemplated nothing less, ultimately, than another invasion of Cuba. The Cubans themselves had come, and the anti-Castro adventurers with them, had come to hate John Kennedy for what they regarded as a failure to back them up. But actually, it was quite different. It was a case of avoiding a war on his part when he agreed with Khrushchev not to invade Cuba again. But they never forgave him for that, and nevertheless, even worse, they were continuing to violate the president's specific order, which is the law of the land, and they were training daily for the ultimate invasion of Cuba. They had a cover name, which they kept secret, but it's kind of surfaced in some recent years. It's called Operation Mongoose. And it looked like, on the surface, like a legitimate a series of forays against Cuba, ostensibly in the national interest, but if you look at the actual description in the 1961 memorandum of Operation Mongoose, as described by Major General Lansdale, who'd spent years in Vietnam, keeping the Vietnam War going, you will see that it was clear that he had in mind once more the ultimate invasion of Cuba and nothing less. And so what you had under the cover of Operation Mongoose, you had this daily training going north of Lake Pontchartrain. That's how New Orleans comes into it. I didn't put New Orleans into it. Sometimes people say, why you, as if I brought New Orleans into it? And the answer, of course, if I was D.A. of Pittsburgh, it wouldn't have been me. But I was D.A. of New Orleans, and New Orleans is where they were setting up this next invasion of Cuba. And every day or so, Dave Ferry would drive from dressed in army combat outfits, black boots, and he'd drive from Bannister's office across the lake and check the training, which consisted largely of shooting, come back and give his report, and it was moving forward pretty steadily until Kennedy learned in late 63... precisely August the 1st, 1963, he learned now that for several years now, his orders against any more anti-Cuba activity, much less preparation for a new land invasion of Cuba, was being violated. So he had to call on the FBI to actually raid the CIA camp where the Cubans and other anti-Castro people were being trained. But even then, the FBI, because the intelligence community protects different parts of each other, did not make it public to the people until we were able to find it out. The troops were being trained there, too, to land in Cuba. But they broke it up for the time being. I'm not sure that made a lot of difference by then. A lot of men had been trained since this was August 1st, 63. An awful lot of men had been trained and were available to do some shooting when November came in Dallas.
This reminds me a little of some of the Iran-Contra activities that certain elements of intelligence through NSC seemed to be carrying on, a foreign policy that was separate, at least from the espoused policy of the executive branch and certainly the foreign policy of the Congress. But in this case, the president acted through the FBI to break up this secret team's activities.
It's not just a little. That's a very good analogy, a metaphor. But it's not just a little. Like, it really is the predecessor to it. In other words, the CIA was in the Kennedy thing was not using just CIA individuals. It was going off the shelf, which is his phrase. Going outside of the agency offices, so forth, and going to taking some civilian groups and other groups off the shelf operation that was building up by 63, which I just described, a force from which you had the central ingredients that actually murdered John Kennedy, which leaves it nothing but a CIA murder of John Kennedy, but the covert elements of the CIA. That's what I want to emphasize. But that was indeed the predecessor of the Iran-Contra business. It was the grandfather of that and the others which followed. I think Casey had in mind setting up a series of off-the-shelf operations, and it probably wasn't the first one the North was involved in.
Friday, November 22nd, 1963. The first day begins at an early morning breakfast meeting. President Kennedy greets an overflow audience.
2 years ago, I said that introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas. Nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear.
A short flight to Love Field at Dallas. Arrival time, 11:37 of the same morning.
It looks like a police convention. We have never seen as many Dallas police officers in one location in all of our years of covering Dallas news, but they are here in great profusion. The security precautions at this luncheon they're going to attend range from the distance from the president's car door to the trademark entrance and to how many doors and windows are in the building, and even the method of selecting the steak the president will eat. And here is the presidential jet, U.S. Air Force number one, printed on the side. And the crowd begins its cheer, which you can't hear over the whistle and hum of the jet. But handkerchiefs are being waved, the placards are being held high, and hundreds of tiny American flags are now being waved toward the presidential jet. The doors fly open, and the loading ladders are being wheeled into place. This is a split-second timed operation for the Secret Service and the Air Force and the Signal Corps. Nothing's left to chance. Every possible precaution has been taken.
You're listening to The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview, Part 1. This 1988 radio documentary was co-produced by David Mendelsohn and Andrew Phillips and includes the voices of narrator Roscoe, former New Orleans DA Jim Garrison, filmmaker Oliver Stone, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Philip Melanson. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Latin listening post interviews with persons more or less directly concerned with the conflict between the United States and Cuba. In subsequent programs, we will present talks with people who are connected with the Cuban refugee organizations, people who are connected with President Batista, and U.S. citizens with direct stakes in the outcome of the Cuban situation. Tonight, we have with us a representative of probably the most controversial organization connected with Cuba in this country. The organization, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The person, Lee Oswald, secretary of the New Orleans chapter to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. This organization has long been on the Justice Department's blacklist and is a group which is generally considered to be the leading pro-Castro body in the nation. As a reporter of Latin American affairs in this city for several years now, your columnist has kept a lookout for local representatives of this pro-Castro group. None appeared in public view until this week, when young Lee Oswald was arrested and convicted for disturbing the peace. He was arrested while passing out pro-Castro literature to a crowd which included several violently anti-Castro Cuban refugees. When we finally tracked Mr. Oswald down today and asked him to participate in Latin Listening Posts, he told us frankly that he would because it may help his organization attract more members in this area. With that in mind, and knowing that Mr. Oswald must have had to demonstrate a great skill in dialectics before he was entrusted with his present post, we now proceed on a course of random questioning of Mr. Oswald. Mr. Oswald, how long has the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had an organization in New Orleans?
We have had members in this area for several months now. Up until about 2 months ago, however, we have not organized our members into any sort of an active group. Until, as you say, this week, we have decided to feel out the public what they think of our organization, our aims. And for that purpose, we have been, as you say, distributing literature on the street for the purpose of trying to attract new members and feel out the public.
Are you at liberty to reveal the membership of your organization?
No, I'm not.
For what reason?
Well, as secretary, I believe it's standard operating procedure that an organization consisting of a political minority protect the names and addresses of its members. And I have that is my duty, and I have every reason to do that.
Mr. Oswald, there are many commentators in the journalistic field in this country that equate the Fair Play for Cuba Committee with the American Communist Party. What's your feeling about this, and are you a member of the American Communist Party?
Well, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, with its headquarters at 799 Broadway in New York, has been investigated by the Senate subcommittees who are occupied with this sort of thing. They have investigated our organization from the viewpoint of taxes, subversion, allegiance, and in general where and how and why we exist. They have found absolutely nothing to connect us with the Communist Party of the United States. In regards to your question about whether I myself am a communist, as I said, I do not belong to any other organization.
I noticed from your pamphlets that
we've been listening to an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, which was done in the summer of 1963. On the line is Dr. Philip Melanson, who is a leading expert and author on the subject of the political assassins, an expert on the subject of intelligence in the United States.
The clip you just played is a classic because he tells the interviewer creates the same impression that he would create for the FBI when, after his arrest, he asked that an FBI agent be brought into his cell so he could give him a lot of information. And both in that radio interview just played and the FBI interview, he made the Fair Play for Cuba chapter sound like a powerful, clandestine, secretive organization when, in fact, it had no members, only a bunch of paper that he generated and only him, and he never tried to find any other kinds of any other members.
Since I was then in the city and happened to be DA and had the responsibility of seeing what Lee Oswald was doing this summer of 63, I went down to 544 camp to look at it and see what it was. And I took one look and I said, hell, this is a side entrance to Guy Bannister's office. I knew Guy. He used to be head of the Chicago FBI office, and during World War II, he was in the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Lee Harvey Oswald, when he was giving out leaflets supposedly in support of Castro, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, 544 Camp Street was stamped on the literature. So this is where 544 comes into the case, through Oswald having worked there in the same building where Guy Bannister was operating.
But just to underscore the significance of what you just said, what you're describing is a situation in which ostensibly communist material has stamped on it an address, 544 Camp, which is the location of part of the intelligence community in New Orleans, meaning, without a question of a doubt, there's prima facie evidence that Lee Oswald was not a communist at all. He was an agent provocateur. We later found out that on the third floor of Bannister's office, he located a small room and cleaned it out and gave it to Oswald to keep his pamphlets in. But you could see Oswald starting out in the morning and Bannister with his gruff voice and his those steel blue eyes saying, Lee, you're doing a good job. Get some more of those pamphlets out today, son. They like what you're doing in Washington. So he goes out and hands them out like he's a communist, but he's the one that calls the news people to come take the pictures, and he's doing, acting out a role as a communist, but he doesn't know they're really fattening him up to be the turkey for Thanksgiving. He's the scapegoat. They're going to have him murdered by making him look like a communist.
Bannister was once the chief of the FBI office in Chicago. How did he first come to your attention in relationship to the assassination, Guy Bannister?
He first came to my attention, well, before the assassination, when I was district attorney, Chet Morrison, the mayor of New Orleans, said, we have a man named Bannister. Looks like he might be a good assistant superintendent of police for that vacancy. And I didn't know much about him, but I said, if he's got a good FBI background, he certainly is organized and sounds good to me. But anyway, how did he first come to my attention was when I, after spending some nights with the Warren Commission, when I had put aside the address 544 camp to check because I saw that Lee Oswald was putting that stamp with his little rubber stamp on papers. He only did it one day and they stopped him. They kind of had a heart attack, I'm sure, but when he was putting that on the papers he was handing out to the public. But he didn't know that he was set to be the scapegoat. So he was doing what he thought was natural. But what actually happened was when he was arrested on August 9th and brought to the first district, first thing he did was to ask to speak to an FBI agent. And the FBI agent came over, Agent Quigley, and very promptly Quigley and Oswald were locked in a private conference for some time.
This is Oswald was arrested?
Yeah, he was arrested on 9th August because of a controversy. It was a setup controversy with other Cubans. In other words, one of those things with another Cuban who at the right time said, Oswald said, hit me, Carlos, and Carlos swung at him and hit him, and then Oswald pleaded guilty. That's just to make it look like he was a troublemaker for the communists. It was all set up. And it was it resolved in those particular pamphlets becoming available to the eye, though, and ultimately available to me. So I put him on a side check, and then a few nights later, I came across in the Warren Commission report. I'm surprised nobody else found it first. I found myself reading Colonel Folsom's 201, his personnel file, 201 file of Lee Oswald and the Marines, and he casually mentioned, and here's Lee Oswald's grades in a Russian test. And somebody must have kicked him under the table because he said he didn't do too well. He got almost as many right as he got wrong, but I wouldn't get any right in a Russian test. With all my years in the military, and I was a major by then, I never took a Russian test. He's a private, taking a Russian examination. And so I realized then that there were signs of intelligence before I left the house and intelligence training of Oswald. For some reason, and this was a few, not long before, when he took this test, not long before he left for Russia. So obviously, in retrospect, he didn't leave as a communist. He left with, as a young Marine with an intelligence assignment because he had, otherwise the Marines wouldn't be teaching him Russian. But I want to see what this sort of place this Russian one, this quote Russian studying Marine was operating out of, and that's what caused me to go down that weekend morning to Lafayette Square and look at 544 Camp Street, where I found, my God, the so-called communist, the lone assassin, the man who's supposed to have murdered John Kennedy, man who was butchered before anybody could ask him too many questions, was an agent provocateur working for the United States government. That address, 544 Camp, was a side entrance to Guy Bannister's office. Around the corner on Lafayette Street was the entrance to Bannister's office. Across the street, where in the post office building, was an office of naval intelligence, and Bannister was naval intelligence in World War II. I knew some of these people. I knew that. And the Secret Service, as a district attorney in New Orleans, I knew where some of these places. Secret Service was also across the street. Around the corner in Lafayette, just across Lafayette Square, around the corner, was the office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And also on another floor, the office of the Central Intelligence Agency. The lone assassin, this person who's been described to all Americans and lied by the lies by the federal government to all the world as a communist was a soldier doing his assignment, a Marine soldier doing what he was taught to do after he was given intelligence training, operating right out of the heart, the very heart of the intelligence community. The reason that the heart is located there so close to the riverfront is that's where all the ships go from New Orleans down to Central America and South America. And a lot of the members of the ship staff, as you might imagine, are intelligence men, too. Nobody was in that office who was not intelligence, Bannister's office. The time that he began operating, the week, is not specific, but it's known that it was through August that he was handing out the pamphlets. And earlier in the summer, he was working around the corner at the Riley Coffee Company. Well, Mr. Riley, not necessarily involved at all, but apparently the nesting place was made available for some requests that the coffee company didn't know the reason for, but request by the intelligence community for this nesting place for Oswald. He was operating out of the Riley Coffee Company. Didn't have that much to do, so he spent most of his time at the Alba Garage next door, which happened to be the garage, and it's something else I was aware of. That was a garage for the intelligence community. It didn't even accept civilian automobiles. It was filled up with the intelligence community. So that's where he spent the earlier part of the summer, and then when August came, he was handing out the pamphlets as an agent provocateur to look like a communist so that when Jack Kennedy was murdered by the covert action elements getting ready to kill him for the CIA, so this foreign policy could be changed back to the Cold War policy. He was being trained like a turkey being fattened for Thanksgiving.
The reception line is formed, and there is Mrs. Kennedy, the First Lady, stepping from the plane, wearing a bright pink suit with a dark fur collar and a matching pink hat. And the president, wearing a dark suit, steps off directly behind. Mrs. Kennedy has been presented her bouquet of brilliant red roses, and they make a lovely contrast to the bright pink suit she is wearing. The weather couldn't be better. We have a brilliant sun at this moment. The wind has diminished considerably, and it has turned into a comfortable situation for the hundreds of people who came here to Dallas Love Field to witness the arrival of the president and his first lady. And here comes the president now. In fact, he's not in his limousine. He's departed the limousine, and he is walking. He is reaching across the fence, shaking hands, shaking hands with many of the people who have come here to see him. He is closely accompanied by Dallas police officers and, of course, the Secret Service.
I was curious after I found out how unquestionably, how clear it was that Oswald was an agent provocateur, that he was working for government intelligence from the outset. I was wondering, how did the U.S. government, the intelligence community, handle his co-workers so that they wouldn't be telling too many people? Well, he didn't get many assignments. This was just a nesting place. He didn't have to do too much. So I sent my chief investigator over there, and he was back in an hour and a half with a list of paper. And every man that had been working with Oswald at the Riley Coffee Company or above him had been, within 2 weeks, had been moved out to a higher paying job out at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Brannion had gone to Chrysler. This man had gone to Boeing. This man was working for NASA itself. Another man was working for NASA. The same thing happened to anybody who helped in the assassination. For example, we arrested David Ferry within 72 hours of the assassination when we stumbled across the fact that he drove across the former friend of Lee Oswald's when he was in the CAP. Drove across. We had a Sunday meeting that reviewed the whole thing. This Kennedy's body is still warm. And we found out that this odd character, David Ferry, who later we learned was working with Oswald out of Bannister's office, had driven across the state line into Texas the day of the assassination. So we waited for him to come back, and when he came back on Monday morning, I had him arrested, brought to my house and office, and said, what your reason for going into Texas at this strange time? And he explained he hadn't been ice skating in years and was seized with the urge to go ice skating. So I said, well, that's very interesting. But how did you happen to pick the heaviest storm in many years to drive there? Well, he couldn't think of an answer to that, so I had him taken over to the FBI, the first district to be held for the FBI for investigation. You couldn't give these guys, I'm trying to give these guys, the assassins, the people who set him up, the case, and they dropped a ferry like a hot potato. They even made a public announcement. Because I guess members of the intelligence community recognized one another, made a public announcement that it was not the FBI's idea to arrest Mr. Ferry, but it was Jim Garrison's. But we got one of the guys involved pretty darn early by accident. We were looking for somebody who was associated with Lee Oswald, and even though he apparently was a agent provocateur, as more and more as it turned out, we wanted to see who was associated with him. We found soon enough that David Ferry was with him frequently. So we had a rejected complaint because it was such a minor case, but it had his address on it. And so we went over to Dave Ferry's house to see what was happening, and we found several kids, friends of his, waiting there for him, and they admitted he'd gone to Texas, waiting for him to come back from Texas. And I noticed a map of Cuba on the wall, all kinds of rifles, all kinds of military equipment, and I realized I wasn't dealing with Joe Smith American, and so we waited for him to come back, and that's when I questioned him, and he didn't answer the questions very effectively. And to make a long story short, we got the right guy, and as the House Committee, although it didn't do a very effective job, it did conclude that there was a conspiracy, and went on to say, 10 years later, one of the signs that a conspiracy existed was Lee Oswald's association with David Ferry. It said that's very strange, but that suggests the possibility of a conspiracy. That's what I was trying to say 10 years earlier. But then it went on to say, but now it was too late to look into.
And there's the gunmetal gray limousine, blue and gray, pulling away now from the fenced area. The President and Mrs. Kennedy seated on the back seat. Governor and Mrs. Connolly on the second seats or jump seats. And then the official driver and Secret Service men in the front seat. A flying wedge of some one dozen Dallas police motorcycles leading the way, and the pace is picking up as they head for the departure gate and the trip downtown to the Trade Mart.
I think this is probably a good point for me to jump in with my hostile question, so to speak. David Ferry, I understand, the weekend of the assassination, or the Friday of the assassination, was working for Carlos Marcello, who was alleged...
Isn't that funny? I have the impression he was working for his boss, Private Detective Ray Gill, but I'll let you take your own speculations.
I hear you, but Gill was Marcello's attorney at the time.
On that particular weekend, that's right. And the next week, he was somebody else's attorney, at which time David Ferry was still working for Ray Gill.
I hear you, and I want to hear more. I want to just put in the question that, as you say, the big theory that's being put forward now is that elements of organized crime were responsible for killing Kennedy.
Let's go straight to that. And you've got a clock watch. Let me just see how many seconds it takes me to dispose in the minds of a reasonable man of organized crime being involved. First of all, the reason given for the contended organized crime, and the listener should understand that this idea was conceived and is spread consistently by the Central Intelligence Agency, so that you will look away from its covert operations and its other murders. The reason given for the supposed involvement of organized crime is so that they could get rid of the Attorney General. Well, if you want to get rid of the Attorney General, truly, all you have to do, Bobby Kennedy it was at the time, is shoot him when he goes to his Justice Department office in the morning or on the way out in the afternoon, because he didn't even have a bodyguard. All he had was a driver who was also the bodyguard. Now, compare that to getting rid of him in the way that the agency wants you to believe the mafia. They say you've got to give the mob credit for having more sense than this. To have to penetrate the huge guard around the President of the United States, the Secret Service protection, the FBI protection, all the other agencies, the protection of the police and the city, in order ultimately to cause his Attorney General to end up without a job, is really not very logical. But let's take another step further. One of the most critical steps in accomplishing the murder was the change of the parade route at the last second. On the morning of the parade, the Dallas Morning News showed that the parade route for the president was to continue as it came to Dealey Plaza, continue on Main Street all the way through Dealey Plaza. That map was 5/6, leaving just one column on the left of the front page, showing so everybody could see the route of the president. Now, what actually happened was when the presidential motorcade came and reached Dealey Plaza, without warning, it turned right. It turned right down Houston and left into Elm. It was a cul-de-sac where the ambush was waiting. And secondly, that double turn, the last leg of which was 120 degrees to the left, slowed his vehicle down to 10 miles an hour where you could hit him with a rock. If he had been going 25 miles an hour, as he had been, out in the meadow as planned, through the center of Dealey Plaza on Main, they would have been able to hit the side of the car with it. But anyway, that's what happened. The parade was changed at the last moment, the parade of the President of the United States.
Now, those of you who are waiting along the parade route, just to be sure that you find yourself in the proper location, let's give it to you once again. It will go Mockingbird Lane to Lemon Avenue, then travel south on Lemon to Turtle Creek, Cedar Springs, through the downtown area on Harwood to Main, west on Main to Houston, through the Triple Underpass to Stemmons Freeway, then on to the Trademark.
President's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the Trademark. I was on Stemmons Freeway earlier, and even the freeway was jam-packed with spectators waiting their chance to see the president as he made his way toward the Trademark. It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Stemmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. I repeat, a shooting in the motorcade in the downtown area. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. The president's car is now going past me. The limousine is now traveling at a very high rate of speed. Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire. Put me on, Phil. Put me on.
coming by here. I can see many, many motorcycles coming by now. Police motorcycles. Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody has been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital. We're on the road to Parkland at this time. The Secret Service man is still spread eagle over whoever is in the car, the President and Mrs. Kennedy, and as we understand, Governor and Mrs. Connolly. At this point, it looks as though it could have been one or two or even all of the people within the car may have been the victims, may have been struck by shots. We don't know. Parkland Hospital in the distance. Now on Harry Hines Boulevard, following behind the motorcade. Many, many police officers, maybe 20 or 25 motorcycle policemen, falling in behind at Trademark. A huge car left behind, waiting expectantly to see the president. The motorcade now perhaps two or three blocks ahead of me. They're approaching the entrance now to Parkland Hospital, traveling at a high rate of speed. Many police cars converging on Parkland from every angle.
I have been ridiculed and worse for suggesting the existence of a conspiracy, as though only kooks and cranks and extremists suggest their existence. But this is the wrong city in which to ridicule people who believe in conspiracies.
On January 15, 1992, Oliver Stone, director of JFK, spoke before the National Press Club in Washington and took questions from the audience.
Is it inconceivable that a president of the United States could sit at the heart of a criminal conspiracy designed to cover up a crime? We know what happened. We would have impeached him for it had he not resigned. Just one jump ahead. Is it so far-fetched to believe in a high-level conspiracy involving the White House, the Joint Chiefs, the Air Force, and the CIA to bomb a neutral country and lie about it in military reports to the rest of the country? But it happened, perhaps more than once. Is it inconceivable the National Security Council leadership, with or without the knowledge of the President of the United States and with the collaboration of the director of the CIA, not just a few rogues, could be engaged in a massive conspiracy to ship arms to our sworn enemy with a casual hope that a few hostages might be released as a result? But it happened. Does it offend our sense of propriety to suggest that an Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America might have regularly lied to Congress about raising money abroad to perform things that Congress had forbidden us to do? But that happened. Is it inconceivable that a campaign manager, later to become the CIA director, negotiated with a foreign country to keep American hostages imprisoned until after a presidential election in order to ensure the election of his candidate? We shall see. But I think no one thinks it is out of the question anymore. So when JFK suggests that a conspiracy involving elements of a government, people in the CIA, people in the FBI, perhaps people associated with the Joint Chiefs, all in the service of the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about, might have conspired to kill John Fitzgerald Kennedy because he was going sharply to change the direction of American foreign policy, is it not appropriate at least to look there for evidence? What was Alan Dulles really up to in those months? Or Charles Cabell, also fired by JFK, or his brother Earl Cabell, the mayor of Dallas? Thomas Jefferson urged on us the notion that when truth can compete in a free marketplace of ideas, it will prevail. There is as yet no marketplace of history for the years of the Kennedy assassination and immediately afterward. Let us begin to create one.
You've been listening to the assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview. This is Guns and Butter.
I have to reiterate one more time that this is not just another murder, not just another assassination, but I insist from the I would stake my life on it. Much as I love this country will not survive as a republic if they continue the Congress and the presidency, the two offices I now hold most responsible, if they continue to fool the people about Jack Kennedy and continue to postpone telling them the truth. Our country will not survive.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, the assassination of JFK, the Garrison Interview Part 2. In this 1988 radio documentary, you'll hear the voice of co-producer and writer David Mendelson interviewing former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of JFK, John Davis, and filmmaker Oliver Stone. Roscoe Mercer narrates. The Assassination of JFK, the Garrison Interview, was co-produced, edited, and directed by Andrew Phillips.
The shots apparently came from the fifth floor of the Texas Bookstore Depository building, possibly from an automatic cut weapon. Police were looking for a young white man dressed in a white shirt with Levi's, carrying a lever-action type rifle. One witness told reporters that he had seen the rifle disappearing from that window after the shots were fired. Senator Ralph Yarbrough told a KVOX reporter that he was riding three cars behind the president's car when he heard three distinct rifle shots. The motorcade then increased in speed, running to Parkland Hospital.
Just a moment. We have a bulletin coming in. We now switch you directly to Parkland Hospital and KVOX News Director Bill Hampton.
The President of the United States is dead. I have just talked to Father Oscar Hubert of the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. He and another priest tell me that the pair of men have just administered the last rites of the Catholic Church to President Kennedy. I asked the father, is Mr. Kennedy dead? And his quote, he's dead all right. And just a few seconds ago, I talked to Thurman Ward, the Justice of the Peace of Garland. He's now here at the hospital to apparently officially declare that the chief executive of the United States has expired. President Kennedy has been assassinated. It's official now. The president is dead.
This is a story about that moment in America when the government changed and the people were excluded. Not just from choosing their leader, but from knowing why their leadership changed. Millions of Americans have seen Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, which focuses on Garrison's investigation in 1967. But very few have heard Judge Garrison recount his work and his message for America in his own words. This is a story about that day in Dallas, the day John Kennedy died.
I think that bringing out the truth is so critical that these words must be said. The American people have to face the fact that this is not an oversight, not a mistake on somebody's part. Every day that passes, high individuals at the very top of the United States government are playing an active role in concealing from you the truth of John Kennedy's murder. Most of the men that are in the Congress who have an IQ of 100 above, or let's say even 50 and above, have to know he was brutally murdered and torn apart, but they no longer really care, apparently, because his name is never even mentioned anymore. And look at the attitude of the presidents, one after the other. These are the chief executives of our country, and yet we've had a succession of presidents now, and not one even mentions the name of John Kennedy. Apparently, they expect us to believe that Jack Kennedy is on sabbatical up at Hyannisport, and everything's all right. Well, everything isn't all right. I suggest that if the government, including the presidents, and including presidents who speak softly of wanting a kinder, gentler nation, how about an honest, also a more honest nation that tells the people the truth, which it hasn't done? Until the presidents and the Congress itself do something about bringing out the truth, I do not think this republic will last. I think it will fall. And if this happens and it falls because the government will not tell the truth, then it deserves to fall.
There are many unanswered questions concerning the death of President Kennedy, and there are several credible theories. This is not a definitive examination of the tragic events of 1963, but the Garrison interview is an important audio document of a crucial and little understood moment of American history.
Let's
let's go back to the weekend of the assassination. And what tipped you off that New Orleans might really be at the center of a possible conspiracy? Guy Bannister was booked that night?
Well, first of all, those things did not tip me off that anything was happening. You must understand, and I plead guilty to believing the government's lie. The biggest lie it told in the history of the human race, I now see, was told by the United States government and continues to be told. But I am one of the people who believed it. And one of the reasons I believed it was I'd been in the Army all my life, 5 years in World War II, 18 years in the National Guard, and the Army had never deceived me or been deceptive, and the Army was a government to me. So I accepted these things without question. Now, the way that I happened to stumble across and gather and look into things from the what we found came across of the Bannister's beating of Jack Martin, what you described, and the police report is dated 22nd of November 1963, the night of the assassination, and how we happened, even though I believe the government's pronouncements, how my office happened to catch David Ferry when he came back in from his weekend trip to Texas, was because I was just doing my duty as a district attorney, because the president had been killed. Lee Oswald had spent the summer in New Orleans, so we were pretty much, you might say, grabbing suspicious people. It just happens, in hindsight, it's clear, but by accident we grabbed people who were relevant, but we did not know that at the time. So that's why I promptly turned Ferry over to the FBI and things like that. And for the next 3 years, I concentrated on burglaries, on robberies, murders, and so forth. So don't give me too much credit. I was not an early... I'm not that quick. I did not see that something was wrong, which I should have. It was apparent, but I didn't see it for 3 years.
Well, why did Bannister beat Martin that night?
The reason Bannister beat Jack Martin that night was Bannister, because of, probably not unrelated to his years as head of the FBI in Chicago, while he was capable of drinking heavily at night, and he would not drink during the day, and was sober as a judge during the day, but on the day of the assassination, he was with Jack Martin, who worked for him. Jack Martin did the detective work, and the office had on the front of it Guy Bannister, private detective. But all Guy Bannister did all day was work on the logistics and the problems of getting additional ammunition to Cuba for raids on Cuba and the training. He was totally working for the CIA, but Jack Martin, who was intelligent, did his detective work. So they were friends, even though they were vitally different, tremendously different personalities. But they'd both been drinking, and Bannister, for the first time to anybody's memory, got completely drunk on the afternoon of the assassination. So they got in an argument. It doesn't have to be a great reason, but two drunks, and they were on the way home at nightfall, home meaning around the corner from the Catch and Jammer bar on Camp Street, around the corner of Lafayette Street to Guy Bannister's office, and somewhere on the way upstairs, on the second floor where the office was, Bannister blew up, and out of the blue, as Jack finally told me, said to Jack that he'd been looking into his filing cases. Well, of course, Bannister was very careful about his filing cases, because there was nothing in there but intelligence. As we later learned out, there were no private cases at all. And they usually kept them locked. But Jack Martin, who was something of a character, he nevertheless was a thoroughly honest man, and he was outraged. And he replied the best way he knew how, and as he said, he was referring to Lee Oswald at the time. He said, "Look, I saw some certain people coming in and out of your office all summer long, and I can say something about that if I want to." And at that point, Bannister, who did not just carry regular sidearm, carried a 357 Magnum, pulled out a 357 Magnum. This is something else he'd never done besides drink in the daytime. He pistol-whipped Martin until they had to get an ambulance over to cart the body away. That's the way that thing developed.
This on November 22nd.
Yes, because and the specific point again was it's funny how quickly it took in time when you stop. It was a matter of hours after the arrest of Oswald. He was arrested at 3 o'clock Dallas time, and this is roughly 5:45 or 6 New Orleans time, and already, too soon for Bannister, already someone who Bannister knows has called his attention that he hasn't forgotten seeing Lee Oswald in and out of that office. So that's why he blew up.
Something I think we should get into, which Garrison never goes into in his book, is how Garrison became interested in reinvestigating the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
John Davis, author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello, and the Assassination of JFK.
Is pretty certain that it was Senator Russell Long who convinced Garrison to reopen the investigation of the JFK assassination. Long was closely associated with Carlos Marcello. He was Marcello's man in Washington. And Marcello was Long's principal financial backer. It was Russell Long who persuaded Garrison that the CIA was behind the JFK murder. So, in a way, you have the sinister possibility that Garrison was being manipulated by Marcello forces to reopen the investigation and to point it in a different direction, pointed away from organized crime and toward the CIA. We have to mention also that another individual who was responsible for convincing Garrison to reopen the investigation was Congressman from Louisiana, Hale Boggs, who was another supporter of Marcello, and Marcello was a backer of his campaigns. And curiously, Hale Boggs was appointed to the Warren Commission by President Johnson. And he also evidently persuaded Garrison that the CIA was behind the assassination. Carlos Marcello was the boss of the second largest mafia family in the United States, which operated throughout Louisiana, Mississippi, and parts of Texas, including Dallas and Houston. This criminal organization was doing a business of something like $2 billion a year in narcotics and extortion schemes, and prostitution rings, I mean, you name it, every conceivable crime you can think of. And so it was an immensely wealthy organization, and Marcello himself was supposed to have been the richest single mafia boss in the whole country. And he came under a sort of special attack by Robert Kennedy when he was Attorney General. He was singled out for special investigation and prosecution because Robert Kennedy was so appalled by this man and what he had gotten away with all his life. And there was a standing order of deportation against him. And Robert Kennedy did something extraordinary that no other attorney general ever did. He did an arguably illegal thing, which was to deport Carlos Marcello in an extra legal way, to literally kidnap him off the streets of New Orleans, throw him on a government plane, and fly him down to Guatemala, where he was dumped. And Marcello later complained that he couldn't call his wife, he couldn't get his toothbrush, he couldn't go to the bank and cash a check. He was just dropped in Guatemala. After that, the Guatemalans deported him to El Salvador, and then he was deported from El Salvador to Honduras. And he spent something like 20 or 30 days hiking through jungles, where he collapsed several times and broke ribs. And it was a terrible ordeal. It was a very humiliating ordeal for such a powerful mafia boss. And he finally legally returned to the United States. And I found at least three reports, reliable reports, that he was swearing vengeance against the Kennedys. When Hoffa was feeling so cornered by Bobby Kennedy, who was prosecuting him, was trying to put him in jail, and eventually succeeded, he felt so cornered that he turned to Regano to deliver a message. This is, of course, according to Regano's story. To deliver a message to Carlos Marcello that he wanted him killed. He wanted Kennedy killed. And more or less take care of it. Do it for me. And it's thought that one of the reasons why Marcello went along with this is that he coveted the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund, which had almost $1 billion in it. And it is thought that Hoffa promised Marcello $3 million from the fund if he pulled off the hit. Frank Regano was an attorney for Jimmy Hoffa and an attorney for Florida Mafia boss Santo Traficante for years. And he also knew Carlos Marcello. And in 1979, a congressional committee determined that the three most likely suspects to have conspired to murder President Kennedy were Jimmy Hoffa, Santo Traficante, and Carlos Marcello, the three people that Frank Regano was in constant touch with. So he's a very logical witness to the conspiracy, which the House Select Committee identified but could not prove back in 79. David Ferry was earning his living at the time as an investigator for Carlos Marcello. He was working on a case which had been brought against Marcello by Attorney General Robert Kennedy. His principal allegiance at the time, his principal connection, was to mob boss Carlos Marcello. Guy Bannister, who was a former FBI agent and had intelligence connections, was also very close to Carlos Marcello. He regularly did investigatory work for him. The two were on very good terms. So I view Bannister more as a creature of Carlos Marcello than I do the CIA. And now we know that Lee Harvey Oswald was also connected to Carlos Marcello, probably perhaps more so than to any specific intelligence agency.
The issue of organized crime versus intelligence is at the center of discussion, if only because, as you say, there are many books that are being published by intelligence that are saying it's the organized crime to get us off the trail. I just wanted to follow up, because it's in the literature. Why wouldn't they have killed Bobby Kennedy? Why wouldn't they have more easily killed Bobby Kennedy rather than President Kennedy? The answer given is, if you kill Bobby Kennedy and then the President Kennedy finds out it was organized crime, then he's still the president. He'll get a new attorney general. He'll go after organized crime like crazy. The other element that's added is that Bobby Kennedy apparently ordered the deportation of Carlos Marcello and left him unceremoniously without his shoes in Guatemala, and Marcello therefore had a motive to come back and get President Kennedy in order to get Bobby Kennedy off his back. I know people are interested in hearing your response to this.
My response is your arguments are impelling. You have won me over. And for the first time, I see that it is so clear that organized crime did it that I don't see how any thinking person could miss. As a matter of fact, I would suggest that it is quite clear that organized crime, which was really played a major role in changing our foreign policy on November 22nd, 1963, was probably helped, not alone, but was probably helped by Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse.
Women here in shock, some fainted. Grown men, Secret Service men standing by the emergency room, tears streaming down their face. There's only one word to describe the picture here, and that's grief, and much of it. It's official. As of just a few moments ago, the President of the United States is dead.
Now I ask you, who has the most power to change the route at the last minute of the President of the United States? A big tuna or cardo, or the security forces of the United States government assigned to protect? That's not all. After the President's and the Secret Service itself participated in the hijacking of the over-the-verbal vocal protests of the Dallas officials because the autopsy is required under Texas law to be held in Dallas for reasons like this. To keep an autopsy from being done in another state under strange controls. Anyway, the body of John Kennedy was whisked out by Air Force One, by federal personnel, and they got it into a military hospital in Bethesda, and it was a military hospital. Now, in that military autopsy, there were 30 men approximately, most in uniforms, almost all military officers of high rank, except for one of the pathologists who was a civilian. The other two pathologists were military, and there were several FBI agents and several Secret Service. So you have entirely federal people. It was so badly rigged that the members of the Warren Commission could not look at it. They put their hands over their eyes, and just to also save them from being embarrassed, the autopsy papers and the x-rays were not even presented to them. They never saw them. The autopsy. And furthermore, the chief pathologist on that Sunday weekend burned the original autopsy in his fireplace. So there you have a rigged autopsy. Now, what room was there for a member of the mob to be participating? That's my reply to people who think the mob was involved.
Why didn't those officials whose responsibility it would be to find the truth find the truth after all these years?
Let me answer that and tell something about the cover-up, but I'd like to say something about the significance of this murder because I think it's been underestimated. Do I have a minute? Okay. First of all, I think I've made the point to the reasonable individual that elements of the covert operations, not the entire structure of the CIA, because John McCone, who was appointed by Jack Kennedy, I know cared for Jack Kennedy, but elements of the covert operations, which was the muscle part, the murder part of the CIA, and consists even now of two-thirds of the CIA. That's one of the first things we ought to do after we change the name of the CIA is get rid of covert operations. You shouldn't have covert operations inside the United States against American citizens. But we do every day, and that's one of the things that has caused this country to cease being a democracy.
With Mrs. Kennedy aboard the presidential jet is Merriman Smith of UPI, Dean of the White House Correspondents.
A Dallas police officer drove me from the hospital to the airport, and I went aboard Air Force One. The large center cabin was dark, all shades drawn, members of the Kennedy staff sitting stunned, staring straight ahead, some crying softly. Sarah T. Hughes, 67-year-old federal judge, old friend of the Johnsons, rushed in a special car to the big white ramp at the front of Air Force One. Someone pressed a small black Bible into the hands of the judge as she went aboard. Secret Service agents gently placed the coffin in the rear cabin of the plane, a cabin, incidentally, which served as the living room for the president and his family when they were airborne. Jackie went to a small bedroom. She wanted a few moments to compose herself. Then Mrs. Kennedy walked down the narrow corridor from her bedchamber and into the lounge. She was dry-eyed, but her face was a mask of shock. As a man might lead a small child, Johnson took her hand and led Jackie to a place at his left side. Mrs. Johnson stood at his right. Johnson then nodded to the judge, and thus a new chapter of American history began.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully
execute
the ceremony had taken only 2 minutes. It was 2:38 p.m. Central Standard Time, and the president called out quite firmly, "Now let's get airborne." The pilot, Colonel James Swindoll, immediately started the engines of the big, gleaming, silver and blue fan jet, and in another few minutes, Air Force One roared down the Dallas runway. Once the plane was airborne, the Johnsons settled down in the lounge where the swearing-in ceremony had taken place. Mrs. Kennedy left her bedroom again and walked slowly down the corridor to the rear cabin. She sat down beside the coffin, and there she remained throughout the flight, never more than a matter of inches from her husband's body. As Air Force One sped toward the nation's capital, Johnson got to work with members of his staff. He drafted what was to be his first public statement. Then he placed a special radio telephone call to Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the late president's mother. By this time, it was dark. We could see the lights of Andrews Air Force Base coming up fast. We put down for a glass smooth landing at 5:59, Washington time.
What was the role of David Ferry? What was the role of Clay Shaw, as far as you can see, in the conspiracy?
The role of David Ferry was, as you might have gathered in my description of Guy Bannister and the anti-Cuban activity, was essentially the right-hand man of Bannister. And from that, we were able to make certain surmises, and I'll give you an example. We knew he was associated with Lee Oswald over the years because we got so many witnesses. And in addition to the fact, witnesses ultimately add Bannisters. It said he was always spending his time with, when he wasn't meeting with Guy Bannister, he was talking with Ferry, always. The kid was always, they called him the kid. His role was the liaison man, the extension. The Guy Bannister was like the commander of the battalion. Had too much to do to leave headquarters. But he said that was apparently related to Ferry's function, rolling right into Texas on the day of the assassination. He never told us, and there's no way of our finding out because he's dead now. But it's rather apparent it was some form of liaison, since he knew so many of the Cuban shooters had been training north of the lake, and he knew the kid postulated just one of many possibilities for one brief second. And you can see if many men were worried about Oswald talking while he was alive until they could get to him and kill him, think of the value of a familiar voice like Dave Ferry calling from Dallas, where it can't be trained, saying, "Lee, thank God I got you on the phone. I'm here in Dallas. We want to reassure you everything is great. You've done a beautiful job. Just keep cool. Everything's working. You're going to be a hero." Something along the line is what I suggest. And that's my first postulation. That's because I don't like to speculate. But he was something along those lines.
We found out that Lee Harvey Oswald actually worked as a runner in the Marcello Gambling Network, the bookmaking network, in the summer of 1963. Oswald's uncle was a key figure in Marcello's gambling network, and Oswald worked as a runner for his uncle. Also, there were reliable witnesses who saw Lee Harvey Oswald in Carlos Marcello's headquarters in New Orleans. As a matter of fact, Ferry, who knew Oswald quite well, was at Carlos Marcello's swampland estate during the 2 weekends preceding the assassination, ostensibly working on the case against Marcello, but we think he was up to other things, such as plotting the assassination of the president.
You're listening to The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview, Part 2. This 1988 radio documentary was co-produced by David Mendelson and Andrew Phillips and includes the voice of former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, author of Mafia Kingfish, John Davis, and filmmaker Oliver Stone. Roscoe Mercer narrates. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Please.
As Jacqueline Kennedy prepares to leave the White House for ceremonies at the Capitol Rotunda, Lee Harvey Oswald is being transferred from the basement of the city jail to the county jail. Ike Pappas, WNEW New York, is on the scene.
Yeah, he's got to be here.
Now the prisoner wearing a black sweater, he's changed from his T-shirt, is being moved out toward an armored car. Being let out by Captain Fritz. There is the prisoner. Do you have anything to say in your defense? There's a shot. Oswald has been shot. Oswald has been shot. A shot rang out. Mass confusion here. All the doors have been locked. Holy mackerel. A shot rang out as he was led into his car.
Garrison almost entirely ignores Jack Ruby, who, of course, was a beacon, a flashing light telling us where the assassination came from, since he was so closely associated with organized crime. And since the killing of a principal suspect as soon as possible after the crime is a time-honored modus operandi of the mafia. Jack Ruby was a minor mobster in Dallas. Dallas was under the jurisdiction of Carlos Marcello. Nobody could operate the rackets in Dallas without Marcello's approval. And Ruby knew a number of Marcello associates. He knew at least two of Marcello's brothers. He was close to Marcello's key deputies in Dallas, Joseph Cervillo and Joseph Campisi. It is safe to say that Jack Ruby was an associate of Carlos Marcello. As was pointed out by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Carlos Marcello was the only figure who had connections to both the suspected assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, and the suspected assassin's killer, Jack Ruby.
Jack Ruby is one of the people who testified to that or spoke to that, saying that the conspiracy was huge.
He was trying to tell, and he said, made no secrets about it. He said he was scared to death of some members of the sheriff's office he didn't identify. But as he told Warren, and the Ford was present too, he said, if you will just get me out of here, I'll tell you about the biggest conspiracy you ever heard of, but I can't do it here. You got about that time, somebody looked at their watch and said, well, it's time for lunch. Literally.
He wanted to get out of Dallas and to Washington, at the very least.
Yes, at the very least. And then we would have learned something about the dimensions, but the people in Washington, they weren't crazy about that idea because they didn't want them to know any more than they knew.
He is white. Pull the chop down there, yelling. Hit the driver. Let the driver by. Oswald White, lying in the ambulance. His head is back. He is unconscious. Dangling. His hand is dangling over the edge of the stretcher. And now the ambulance is moving out. The flashing red lights.
Here are some police officials.
Who was he?
Jack Ruby is the name.
Jack Ruby?
Ruby. Carousel Club.
He runs the Carousel Club?
Yes, sir.
He handed me that card the other day. He was in...
What did he say?
He was in the carousel... He was in the headquarters here.
This gentleman deserves more by the night.
Perhaps we'd finish with maybe where we might have begun. If people still have a question in their minds whether Lee Oswald was acting alone or not, what comes to your mind as some of the most obvious and strongest proofs that Oswald was acting in concert with others?
Look at what really happened. First of all, later when they attempted, after the assassination, when experts, the world's leading experts, attempted to duplicate the feat, with Oswald's rifle, they could not even begin to duplicate the feat. So that alone indicates that Oswald did not do it. But even more than that, Oswald's gun was so bad, that Mannlicher Carcano was so bad, that it was predictable. It couldn't be done. But furthermore, even before the experts could hit the side of a barn, they had to have the sight adjusted. The sight was loose and not adjusted. And when you looked through the sight, you weren't looking down the same line as the tube. But moreover, and the final, most tragic thing of all, and I'll finish the point with this, in any American, most Americans, I think, have a feeling about other people in the human race. It's a great thing about our country that we know that we're not made up of a dominant portion of cruel people. Lee Oswald was exonerated from firing a rifle on the evening of the assassination. The nitrate test showed he hadn't fired a rifle at all. And yet, the men in charge of this operation, not only the assassination, but now the cover-up, were so cruel and so heartless that it wasn't enough to kill the president. And said, I may buy and let Oswald be killed as an assassin when they knew he hadn't killed the president. But it took 8 months before the rest of America found out that Oswald had not fired a rifle at all, because it was in the small print of the Warren Report. And so that's one of the most terrible things to happen, but now that can't be undone. And then finally, what did he think he was doing? It's become pretty clear in general terms what he was doing, but in precise terms, nobody from the FBI has told us. He was working with the FBI. A piece of news that surfaced early on, and the Warren Commission almost went to pieces trying to cover it up. And that was when his number surfaced, when he said, in effect, look, fellas, what, I don't know what you're trying to do to me. I'm working for the FBI. I'm trying to find out what's going on, too. My number is S-179. That was a part of the standard number for an FBI informant. Well, of course, that was squashed before anybody could even get a start on it.
How did you first hear about Clay Shaw's involvement in the conspiracy? And then what evidence did you develop against him?
We did not hear about his involvement in the conspiracy precisely. We learned that from an attorney, again, I seem to have been in the accident of knowing all these individuals. It probably helped because I knew who was lying and who wasn't. And I stumbled across the fact early on that Dean Andrews, an attorney who for years handled cases for Clay Shaw, although we didn't know that at the moment. Andrews specialized in municipal court cases largely, and had an office on which, and was also handling some papers for Lee Oswald with regard to getting citizenship for Marina. And Bannister had made a call on the day after the assassination to Dallas, Texas, to Oswald's jail. Now, the setup for Oswald, incredibly enough, by now you've seen the curious nonchalance of the Dallas police force in operation. Oswald was both receiving and making calls. Here's a man who just supposedly, I emphasize, killed the president because he killed no one. As far as the jailer knows, he killed the president, but nevertheless, he'd say, Lee, is another call for you, and they'd bring him to the phone, and then whenever he wanted to make a call, he'd give the number to the jailer, and the jailer would make the call and bring him over and keep all those papers together. And so Andrews had received a call, as he testified later to this. He told me, and when I questioned him, and then told the FBI, and he told the Warren Commission, he received a call from a man he identified as Clay Bertrand, asking him to represent Lee Oswald. He said something about him in the hospital. He was in Charity Hospital at the time. I don't know if I can, and let me think that over. And about the time he put down the receiver, about 25 FBI men hit the door, you know, because they were monitoring those lines. Parenthetically, if some listener might be curious as to what happened to all the calls that Oswald made and received, which certainly got my curiosity. I must have spent 50 hours digging them down. And the bottom line was that the jailer said, oh, he kept them religiously. He kept every call coming in and kept them all. But one day he came in, looked in his drawer, and they were all gone. He doesn't know what happened to them. But anyway, that's how we know. We learned that Dean Andrews had received such a call, but the name Clay Bertrand we weren't that familiar with. So when we found that, obviously going through the questions, we got copies of the FBI interview of Oswald, and we got copies of, because this went on now for several years, by the late spring of 64, Dean Andrews had testified for the Warren Commission. I studied his testimony, and I observed how increasingly frightened he became when he was asked who Clay Bertrand was. As a matter of fact, the more he was asked about Clay Bertrand's identity, the more steadily Clay Bertrand shrunk, because he was 6'3" when Andrews first described him to the FBI, but by the time the Warren Commission asked him how tall Clay Bertrand was, he was only 5 feet tall. Well, usually that's a sign that the man that is being answering the questions isn't completely comfortable with his situation. He's trying to get out of it. Well, we knew that he couldn't be both, and we knew that Andrews was lying. So after I had a long conversation with Andrews and told him, look, Dean, in effect, we went to law school together. You're a friend of mine. I like you. But let me make one thing clear. If you continue to lie to me like you did to the FBI and the Warren Commission, you're not just going to walk out. You're going to go in front of the grand jury, and if you lie to the grand jury, you're going to jail. Well, that's what happened, of course. And we convicted him of perjury in front of the jury. That was the first conviction in the Kennedy case. There was a conviction, unlike what people say. That was the first.
I'd like to hear your view of the role, if any, in the conspiracy to carry out the murder of President Kennedy and the cover-up of people like J. Edgar Hoover, Alan Dulles, Earl Warren, President Johnson. What's your view about those people?
Let's take each one of those four. And first of all, it goes much higher than I've described. Naturally, I'm describing a tactical level, which we stumbled across, which is handling it. But you don't remove a president is not removed to change foreign policy just because a handful of people at a tactical level decide to do so. I think that you can safely say that individuals such as J. Edgar Hoover were actively involved at the outset, because Hoover not only wanted to see Johnson in office. He lived across the street from him in Washington for 19 years, probably his closest friend. And he had become senile, frankly. In other words, it's fine to be against communism, and I am, everybody is probably, to a reasonable degree. But when you reach a point like J. Edgar Hoover, where you think every man who doesn't wear a hat and a handkerchief in his pocket as a communist, he became a very, very dangerous man. So I would put him as one of the people involved at the highest level. Now, as to Johnson, there's an old adage in intelligence which is very seriously regarded, and it's important. It's on a need-to-know basis. In other words, you don't give information, no matter how trustworthy they are, to people who don't need to know, because it saves the number of people you have to tell. Johnson was such a natural hawk that they knew they could change the policy back to the Cold War without telling him. So I suggest the likelihood that is on a need-to-know basis. They didn't bother to tell him because he was so totally corrupt they didn't have to tell him anyway. Alan Dulles is, without the slightest doubt, a major participant in the conspiracy to kill Kennedy and to change the foreign policy. Because to appreciate Dulles, you have to understand that he is the man. Even though the CIA was formed out of the OSS, it was really when Dulles took over. Because of its origins in the OSS, special emphasis was given early on to the covert operations. But Dulles, it was really under Dulles that killing became a science in the CIA, and something regularly done and accepted and done to Americans within America. That was truly an evil man. And I am satisfied that of all the corrupt things that Lyndon Johnson ever did, appointing Alan Dulles to sit on the Warren Commission and find out who killed John Kennedy was very much like appointing Brutus to investigate the death of Julius Caesar to see who killed him. He knew exactly who killed him and how he was killed, and he knew he was going to be killed beforehand. I have no doubt about that.
Well, the other name was Earl Warren, but I'd like to see...
Earl Warren, I think, is I have to look at that in a different way. I think he was fooled. I really think he was fooled. He was called in. It happened in a confrontation with Johnson. You see, they had structured in so many false sponsors, and one you've asked me about with justification, the mob, and then they had, they structured in Castro, and they structured in the Oro Barons. It was a beautifully done plan, and probably with the final approval of people at the dullest level. But anyway, you have to assume that in the case of Warren, by getting him in, you stopped the liberals from coming in too deeply. And that was what was so cynical about the plan, but it was beautifully done. When he left Warren's office, he knew nothing about it. When he left Warren's office, he had tears running down his face, and I know what they told him. They'd also structured in the possibility of some kind of Russian response, if there was going to be a sign of warfare, something like that. And I can almost visualize Johnson, who would a man who would climb a tree to tell a lie. I can see Johnson saying, Chief, or whatever he called him, we need your help. The nation needs you now more than ever, and so forth. So they got an honest, well-intentioned man who wasn't, to say, the greatest intellectual in the world, and fooled him, and had so him sitting there surrounded by people who were really running the thing, like Alan Dulles.
What about the level between Bannister and these people at the level of a Dulles or a Hoover? Do you have information?
No. I can't pretend to have a magic globe, and I've been carefully insulated from all that, so I won't speculate. I found it clearly up to Bannister. I can see how he worked, but I don't pretend to have inside knowledge of that upper gap whereby it goes up to the top level of covert operations. But I do think it had to go to some of the highest individuals of covert operations, because you're not merely changing foreign policy, you're removing a president of the United States to do it. And in that regard, I have to reiterate one more time that this is not just another murder, not just another assassination, but I insist from the I would stake my life on it. Much as I love this country will not survive as a republic if they continue, the Congress and the presidency, the two offices I now hold most responsible, if they continue to fool the people about Jack Kennedy and continue to postpone telling them the truth. Our country will not survive.
We certainly know now that the Mafia worked with the CIA and was used by the CIA. We have documents that show the CIA used crime elements in various countries to do some of its work. They work hand in hand, as discussed in several scenes in the movie.
On January 15th, 1992, Oliver Stone, director of JFK, spoke before the National Press Club in Washington and took questions from the audience. He answers a question some may feel was not fully addressed in the interview. Stone was asked about Garrison's failure to win a conviction in the Shaw trial and whether Garrison wasn't really just trying to gain publicity for himself in an attempt to run for governor of Louisiana.
Mr. Garrison in the film says it is just inconceivable to him that the Mafia would have the organizational ability to bring an Oswald in and out of Russia, to get him a job in a book depository, to design the parade route and motorcade in such a way that it would bring Mr. Kennedy beneath the building in such a way. And beyond that, how would the mob cover up the autopsy and appoint the Warren Commission?
Your depiction of Garrison as Robin Hood is grossly distorted. Clay Shaw was acquitted in less than an hour, a fact you conveniently ignore. Garrison was using Shaw as a clay pigeon. He wanted to be governor and was using Shaw to gain fame. Please comment.
Why anyone would, in 1967, seek to be a governor of a state by going against it, the CIA and the entire government suggesting they killed its president is beyond me. Your political life, Jim's political life was over the moment he brought those charges. He was taking on the establishment in a major way, and he paid a heavy price for it. As to the case itself, I just would want to remind you that he has been vilified and trashed over and over and over again in the press. He has now become a non-person in a sense that Stalin's opponents, Bukharov and Trotsky, became non-persons. There are no specifics that are ever brought up. It's been a media mantra, a buzzword, a coda, a credo. The journalists cite each other to substitute for critical analysis. Jim had an interesting history. He was an FBI man. He was a war hero. He was elected 3 times DA of New Orleans. Why? Not by the establishment, but because he was popular. He was unpopular in the press, in the Times-Picayune. He was unpopular with Clay Shaw's friends. He was unpopular with the establishment of New Orleans. But he was elected 3 times. And then he's since become an appellate judge in that same city after the trial. He had a case. There were 2 evidentiary hearings. He went to a 3-judge panel, criminal judges. He presented his facts. Those 3 judges in 1967 said, go to trial. He went to a grand jury of 12 jurors. They said, go to trial. It was hardly the frolic described, and it was not a whim. He had witnesses, and he had evidence. 3 major witnesses, however, died before he could get to trial. Obviously Oswald, obviously Ruby is part of it, but we have Guy Bannister and we have David Ferry. These were key witnesses in the possible connection of Shaw, Bannister, and Ferry. We have since the trial found significant evidence that Shaw knew Oswald, not only through Perry Russo, but through the Clinton witnesses from Clinton, Louisiana, 10 people, 8 of them black, I believe, pointed to Shaw as being in Clinton that day with Lee Oswald at a core rally. Dean Andrews pointed to Clay Shaw, or pointed to a man called Clay Bertrand, who Jim found out to be Clay Shaw. That testimony was thrown out of court by the judge, and the scene that we show in the movie with the officer not being allowed to testify. We do believe that Clay Shaw was Clay Bertrand. The jury came back and said that there was no that Shaw was not guilty, but they all, when they were polled after the trial, they said that Jim Garrison had convinced them that there had been a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, but they couldn't make the link to Clay Shaw. By the way, Jim Garrison did make his summation speech. Several people have said he did not. He did make that summation speech. And 80% of it is in the movie, in the scene. We added some from his Playboy interview. And a couple of little polishes for me, but essentially that is his speech and that is his summation. Judge Haggerty, who presided over the case and who, in a sense, hurt Jim's case by refusing to take the Clay Bertrand testimony, said after Clay Shaw died, he waited until Clay Shaw died in 73, he said in a television interview, I do believe to this day that the jury should have found Clay Shaw guilty. I do not believe Clay Shaw told the truth at the trial. After the trial, we come in possession of a picture that shows that Clay Shaw and David Ferry were at a party together. I think that Shaw perjured himself time and again at that trial, denying that he knew Oswald, denying that he knew Ferry, and denying that he was a member of the CIA, which we find out that he was. Call him what you want, domestic contact, et cetera, he has a history with the CIA. It was pointed out by Richard Helms. Finally, under oath, he told the truth. And Victor Marchetti supports that theory, saying that during the trial, Mr. Helms was very concerned with the fate of Clay Shaw and offered all the help he could. In addition to that, we now know that Mr. Shaw was on the board of directors of Permindex, a fascist organization in Italy that was thrown out of Italy for illegal espionage activities. Among them, promoting financial transactions and the attempted assassination of Charles de Gaulle, the president of France. So I do not think we have here this innocent businessman pictured by the press. I think we have a serious case that was brought and lost and failed, and we have that is as it is. But there is something more than meets the eye. I would liken Jim Garrison's case somewhat to the Lawrence Walsh case of the 1980s when he tried to bring that same covert arm of the government to the light of day, and he failed. Jim's subpoenas on Dulles, on Cabell, on Helms were all squashed by the Justice Department in Washington.
The final question I have is what people should do to try and bring about a reopening of the case. I think they should start by reading your book, On the Trail of the Assassins, so that they have a clearer picture of what's going on in this country. But what do you think people can do? Is there anything we can do?
I think the only thing can do that can be done, I do think that would be a good start, because I put 6 years on something I could have done in two. The reason I put 6 years is on the trail of the assassinations was to make it irrefutable. So even someone who begins doubting my position or something will have to end up seeing what happened and what the government did. Then the second thing, and I cannot tell the people how to do this because I'm not a seer nor a prophet, but I can only tell them that my instincts, and from the bottom of my heart I have the feeling, that they must then somehow communicate to two groups, the Congress and the Executive Department, that they will no longer take the lie. If they have to do like the Chinese youths did, the students did, and block the military from coming into the square, whatever they have to do, they have to tell the government, we will not take this lie anymore. Make this government the way it's supposed to be and stop telling us an unbelievable lie, because we won't take it.
An interview with Judge Jim Garrison. He has done his part to rescue the true history of America by giving the lie to the Warren Report's fictions. Oliver Stone's powerful movie has burst the lid off the cover-up, and the assassination is no longer a taboo subject for public debate and action. However, neither Stone nor Garrison claim to know the whole truth. And a solid majority of Americans believe that Oswald was not alone. In effect, America believes that an unknown group of activists successfully murdered the president and may still be at large. And perhaps more significantly, that our government has never been able to mount an honest attempt to openly investigate what happened. If the government's intelligence arm cannot be examined about its actions 28 years later on a matter of this magnitude, how can Americans believe that we are governed through an open system reflecting the will of an informed public, a government of, by, and for the people? Perhaps at last, America is claiming the right to its history. Perhaps our society may now be ready to face the truth and the meaning of what happened in Dallas the day John Kennedy died. Perhaps.
You've been listening to The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview, Part 2. In this 1988 radio documentary, you've heard the voice of co-producer and writer David Mendelsohn interviewing former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of JFK, John Davis, and filmmaker Oliver Stone. Roscoe Mercer narrated. The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview was co-produced, directed, and edited by Andrew Phillips. Andrew Phillips is currently the interim general manager of KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California, part of the Pacifica Network. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org. That's gunsandbutter.org.